Joe Biden declares victory in the U.S. presidential election, vowing to tackle climate change and systematic racism in the country as part of his mandate. The U.S. president's campaign says it has filed a lawsuit in Arizona alleging the state's Maricopa County incorrectly rejected ballots cast by some voters on Election Day. People take to the streets in Pakistan's Karachi to denounce the French president's approval of blasphemous cartoons depicting the Prophet Muhammad. Welcome to the program. Our top story, U.S. President-elect Joe Biden has delivered his victory speech among his supporters in the state of Delaware, pledging to heal a divided America.
For all those of you who voted for President Trump, I understand the disappointment tonight. I've lost a couple times myself, but now let's give each other a chance. It's time to put away the harsh rhetoric, lower the temperature, see each other again, listen to each other again. And to make progress, we have to stop treating our opponents as our enemies.
Biden promised to make the United States respected around the world again, vowing to tackle climate change and systemic racism in the country. Several U.S. news networks, including the Associated Press, CNN, and Fox News, declared Biden the 46th U.S. president after he extended his lead in the battleground state of Pennsylvania. His electoral vote count now stands at 290, surpassing the 270 he needed to enter the White House. Biden's supporters poured into the streets in front of the White House and several other cities to celebrate the win. Trump, however, has repeatedly made allegations of election fraud and vowed to challenge the result in courts. He's challenged the results in several states. In a statement, Trump said Biden is rushing falsely to pose as the winner, and the election is far from over. Trump's latest lawsuit was filed in Arizona, where he pledges, or alleges that is, that Maricopa County incorrectly rejected votes cast by in-person voters on Election Day. Political commentator Lawrence Davidson says U.S. President-elect Biden is now faced with the challenge of bringing together a divided America.
So there's a couple of things that we have to watch. One is the divisiveness and essentially what will Trump's fanatical followers do. There's no chance of them taking power. There's going to be no coup or anything like that. But in fact, there might be sporadic episodes of violence that will have to be dealt with. So we've got to watch for the divisiveness and the sporadic violence that is likely. Now, in terms of domestic policy, we've all, escaped domestic barbarism for the next 4 years. And it's in foreign policy that we can look for some significant changes.
Thousands of Pakistanis hold a new rally in the city of Karachi to protest against French President Emmanuel Macron's anti-Islam stance. Protesters denounce Macron's Islamophobic remarks and policies and call for a boycott of French products. The demonstration is the latest in a series of anti-Macron rallies in different Muslim states. Last month, Macron outraged the Muslim world by defending the publication of insulting cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad under the pretext of freedom of speech or expression. This came after a teacher was beheaded by one of his students for showing the blasphemous caricatures. The United States has blacklisted the leader of Lebanon's largest Christian political bloc. In our news review program, we discussed the latest developments in Lebanon.
And now it's time for this hour's news review. Well, Lebanon's president has called on the U.S. to offer evidence and documents for imposing sanctions on prominent Christian politician Gebran Basil, who was also the president's son-in-law. Michel Aoun asked the country's caretaker foreign minister to obtain the data and submit it to Lebanon's judiciary to, quote, take the necessary legal measures. The U.S. has blacklisted the leader of Lebanon's biggest Christian political bloc over alleged corruption and ties to the Lebanese resistance movement. Washington deems Hezbollah a terrorist group, and Hezbollah has condemned the blacklisting as a blatant and gross interference in the country's internal affairs. Basil says that U.S. sanctions will not intimidate him or force him to turning his back on the Lebanese people. I'd like to welcome my guest to this news review. Out of Beirut, Mariam Saleh, and also out of Beirut, journalist Mohammed Khaled. Thank you so much for being with us. Let's start off with Mariam. And Mariam, will fill us in on the latest and what's going on.
Well, we were expecting that there would be more people who were put on the blacklist, and maybe this is probably the final blow for Trump before maybe a possible defeat in the internal presidential election. But of course, when you look at this accusation, it seems that the Americans don't really have much on their plate. They don't have much evidence, and this is why we get from the statement of Hezbollah, who denounced, of course, they clearly denounced this this accusation, calling it political. And what they said is that the United States is using as a pretext its own internal laws and the laws that, in order to fight terrorism, to use them against the allies of the resistance, and under the pretext of fighting corruption. This is something that many are looking at as being ironic. You have people who were in power in Lebanon since the civil war, since 1975 until today. They are still in power, and they are the ones who have been clearly corrupt. They have caused this corruption. They are, whether in the parliament or through being ministers or so on. Like, for example, the Falangist Party. You have some of the Druze parties as well. So many of those people who were in power are clearly responsible for the corruption that took place for over 30 years in the country. And still no sanctions have been forced on them, sorts of measures have been taken against them. And now they come for Jabran Basile, who hasn't been in power more than a decade, and saying that he is accused of corruption. This is something that many are finding very ironic, and this is why President Michel Aoun is clearly wants to take legal measures, and we'll see how the foreign minister what he can get from the on legal issues, what type of documents he can get in order to perhaps respond to this issue. Mm-hmm. And of course, Hezbollah has considered this a clear violation of a country whom they say is not only a sponsor of the terrorism around the world, but also a sponsor of corruption and of corrupt states and dictatorship regimes as well. So Hezbollah was clear in this and that response. And of course, we're probably going to hear something which is official, but we are in the state of a caretaker cabinet. And this is why I think the president now is the only one who could probably take legal measures.
Okay. Mohammed, your take on this. Why do you think that the U.S. has sanctioned Basile at this point in time, and what is it really about?
My dear friend, there are two factors in this issue. The first issue that concerns the formation of the new government led by Saad al-Hariri. The U.S. has been trying to put obstacles into forming a new government ever since the resignation of the caretaker government right now of Hassan Diab. We have seen this during Mustafa Adib, the previous nominee for heading the government. They have placed several obstacles, internal obstacles, in order to rule out any government formation. Now we have Saad al-Hariri, who has close ties with the Americans, with the French, and with also Arab Gulf states. And this is one of the obstacles that they are putting, since now there is a certain vagueness that, well, Trump basically is losing the presidency, so now the Lebanese politicians are still waiting for the outcome of the U.S. elections in order to know what kind of policies Biden will go by. Will he stay with these sanctions, or will he cancel them? This is one point. The other point is that Bashir is being a very close ally and very strategic and important ally to Hezbollah, which is designated by the U.S. as a terrorist group. They have issued certain warnings, indirect warnings for the close allies of Hezbollah, particularly Bashir and the Free Patriotic Movement. They have placed also sanctions on two of Hezbollah's allies, with whom are Amal Movement and the Marada Movement as well, two of their former ministers. So this is basically putting more pressure on Hezbollah by targeting its allies in order for its allies to turn their back on Hezbollah and to designate it as a terrorist group. It's part of the whole U.S. Pressure on Lebanese politics and adding more and more complications to the Lebanese political and economic life, which as Lebanese we have been suffering from huge and disastrous economic turmoil and inflation for the past year or so. Thus, as I repeat, that the two main factors in this issue is a pressure on the Lebanese government, especially that they don't want anything that the Americans are trying to place their rules and their conditions on the newly to be formed Lebanese government, that they will not accept any minister that is either directly or indirectly related to Hezbollah.
Okay, and on that note, I appreciate both of you being with me here on this news review, both out of Beirut, Mariam Saleh, and journalist Mohammed Klett.
A Palestinian prisoner who had been on hunger strike for over 100 days, I suppose, since he was arrested by Israeli military forces, has ended his strike following an arrangement, I should say an agreement, with Israeli authorities to release him late this month. Ruba Shabat is in Gaza.
Maher al-Akhras, a Palestinian inmate at Israeli jail, has suspended his hunger strike that lasted for over 100 days and won his freedom after forcing Israeli regime to release him. The Palestinian Prisoners Committee in the Gaza Strip marked this victory during a press conference in front of the Red Cross office and stressed that the Palestinian resistance will continue till all Palestinian inmates at Israeli jails are freed.
Maher al-Akhras' long hunger strike showed the Palestinians' patience and resistance. Today we're celebrating this victory. Maher's resistance led to his release amid the silence of the international community.
The 49-year-old Palestinian prisoner, a father of six, was detained on July 27 and held under a four-month administrative detention order with no charge and based on alleged secret evidence not available even to his lawyers. He went on hunger strike to protest his arrest and condition.
Release of Maher al-Akhras is a victory not only for him but also for all Palestinians. Hunger strike is an effective means of resistance in the face of the Israeli administrative detention policies.
The Palestinian man would spend the remaining period of his current term in hospital for medical treatment.
Maher al-Akhras's health condition is still unstable. His victory reveals the violation of Palestinians' rights and provides us with more energy to work harder to free all Palestinian detainees from Israeli jails.
There are currently 350 Palestinian detainees in Israeli prisons without charge. The Palestinian Commission of Detainees Affairs said earlier this week, three of them have been on hunger strike in solidarity with Akhras.
Maher al-Akhras held one of the longest hunger strikes that led to his release. There are thousands of Palestinian inmates who suffer at Israeli jails. Al-Akhras' victory reminds the international community of the urgency to save the life of those inmates.
Maher al-Akhras has ended his hunger strike at Israeli jails after 100 days, when the Zionist regime was finally forced to release him, marking another victory for the Palestinian cause. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
Israelis have held fresh demonstrations against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in Jerusalem al-Quds. Protesters gathered outside Netanyahu's residence to condemn his policies and call for his resignation. Scuffles broke out after several people were arrested. The demonstrations came despite a ban on protests. Israelis have been staging street rallies over the past months to protest soaring unemployment, a hike in COVID-19 infections, and a return of coronavirus restrictions. Adding to anti-regime sentiments are the corruption charges facing the prime minister. Netanyahu went on trial in May for bribery, fraud, and breach of trust, but he denies any wrongdoing. Coronavirus pandemic surges across Europe, with several countries reporting new record highs in the number of infections and fatalities. Italy registered nearly 40,000 cases, the highest ever daily tally since the pandemic started. In the UK, officials said daily infections rose by almost 25,000. Austria posted a record high number of more than 8,400 infections and nearly 30 deaths. The death toll surpassed the 40,000 mark in France, where over 1.6 million cases have been reported. In Poland, the health ministry announced a record number of nearly 28,000 cases, bringing the total infections to over 500,000. The Czech Republic confirmed more than 11,500 new cases, raising its total tally to more than 403,000. Iran has reported another single-day record for coronavirus infections. Health Ministry spokeswoman Sima Saadat-Lari said more than 9,400 people contracted the disease in the past 24 hours, bringing the total number of cases to over 673,000. The country also reported 423 new fatalities in the same period. That takes the total number of deaths to almost 38,000. The number of deaths and infections has been on the rise in Iran. The country has reported several new highs since September. Officials have implemented restrictive measures, including a ban on travel in and out of five major cities.
Lock Tehran down, or the coronavirus pandemic would spiral out of control. This is a demand made by Tehran's city council, as well as some MPs, amid an unabated surge in infections and fatalities. As the coronavirus has resurged over the past month across Iran, experts have raised the alarm over the soaring figures, especially in the densely populated capital.
Currently, there are over 32,000 hospitalized COVID patients. Out of this figure, 6,800 are in critical conditions and kept in ICUs. Our medical system has for the past 9 months been under severe pressure. Our medical workers are tirelessly working to fight the virus.
Last week, the government doubled down on its COVID restrictions, banning and imposing fines on unnecessary intercity travels. The government has also extended remote work for civil servants and mandated mask wearing, fining those who go out without a face mask.
The government is not doing enough to contain the virus. It keeps advising people to stay home while ignoring the fact that those people need to work to handle their family's expenses. The government should provide taxi drivers and others like us with handouts enough for a month-long expenditure. This way, we can afford staying home.
Some people seem to be still unaware of the gravity of the crisis. The law enforcement should take strict measures to stop them from roaming around in parks and other public places. As long as the pathetic citizens are not facing punishment, the virus is here to stay.
Over the past 2 months, coronavirus fatalities in Iran have more than quadrupled, with the latest figures hovering about 400. Since the outbreak of the virus in the country, plus 660,000 have tested positive, and more than 37,000 have lost their lives. The health ministry says it has proposed a two-week enforced lockdown in the capital as the last shot in bringing the soaring numbers to a halt.
As the resurging virus continues to claim more lives, experts say it's still too soon to pin hope on a treatment or a vaccine. They say prevention is still the only weapon against the virus, on the condition that everyone is armed with that weapon. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
A diverse range of programs. Youth, spirituality, culture, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
According to NASA estimates, there are at least 100 billion stars in the Milky Way galaxy, of which about 4 billion are sun-like. If only 7% of those stars have habitable planets, a seriously conservative estimate, there could be as many as 300 million potentially habitable Earth-like planets out there in the whole Milky Way alone. Ravi Kumar Kapparapu, a researcher at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland, said, "We want to be very conservative in case nature has any surprises regarding habitability." He added, "So we are lowballing the estimates intentionally. On average, the astronomers calculated the nearest such planet should be about 20 light years away, and there should be 4 of them within 30 light years or so of the Sun." We're prepared for you an article written by Dennis Overby, titled "Looking for Another Earth? Here are 300 million, maybe." The article has appeared in the New York Times. Please stay with us for more of Dennis Overby's article. A decade ago, a band of astronomers set out to investigate one of the oldest questions taunting philosophers, scientists, priests, astronomers, mystics, and the rest of the human race. How many more Earths are out there, if any? How many far-flung planets exist that could harbor life as we know it? Their tool was the Kepler spacecraft, which was launched in March of 2009 on a 3.5-year mission to monitor 150,000 stars in a patch of sky in the Milky Way. It looked for tiny dips in starlight caused by an exoplanet passing in front of its home star. When the mission was launched in March of 2009, William Borucki said, "It's not ET, but it's ET home." It was Borucki, an astronomer now retired from NASA's Ames Research Center, who dreamed up of the project and spent 2 decades convincing NASA to do it. Before the spacecraft finally gave out in 2018, it had discovered more than 4,000 candidate worlds among those stars. So far, none have shown any sign of life or habitation. Granted, they're very far away and hard to study. Extrapolated, that figure suggests that there are billions of exoplanets in the Milky Way galaxy. But how many of those are potentially habitable? After crunching Kepler's data for 2 years, a team of 44 astronomers led by Steve Bryson of NASA Ames Research Center has landed on what they say is the definitive answer, at least for now. Their paper has been accepted for publication in the Astronomical Journal. Kepler's formal goal was to measure a number called Eta Earth, the fraction of sun-like stars that have an Earth-sized object orbiting them in the Goldilocks or habitable zone, where it is warm enough for the surface to retain liquid water. The team calculated that at least one-third, and perhaps as many as 90% of stars similar in mass and brightness to our own Sun have rocks like Earth in their habitable zones, with a range reflecting the researchers' confidence in their various methods and assumptions. That is no small bonanza, however you look at it. According to NASA estimates, there are at least 100 billion stars in the Milky Way galaxy, of which about 4 billion are sun-like. If only 7% of those stars have habitable planets, a seriously conservative estimate, there could be as many as 300 million potentially habitable Earth-like planets out there in the whole Milky Way galaxy alone. Ravi Kumar Kapparapu, a researcher at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland, and one of the authors of the report, said, "We want to be very conservative in case nature has any surprises regarding habitability." He added, "So we are lowballing the estimates intentionally. On average, Astronomers calculated the nearest such planet should be about 20 light years away, and there should be four of them within 30 light years or so of our own sun. Natalie Batalha, an astronomer at the University of California at Santa Cruz, who directed the Kepler mission during most of its life and was one of the authors of the new paper, in a triumphant email said, "It took 11 years from launch to publication, but this is it." She added, "This is the science result we've all been waiting for, the reason that Kepler was selected for flight in December of 2001. The new result means that the galaxy is at least twice as fertile as estimated in one of the first analyses of Kepler data in 2013. That finding by Andrew Howard, Eric Petigura, and Jeffrey Marcy, who were not part of the Kepler team, concluded that about one-fifth of Sun-like stars harbored planets in their habitable zones. Natalie Batalha said that one improvement this time around was the addition of data from the European Gaia satellite, which has measured the position and brightness of 1 billion stars. The knowledge allowed the Kepler scientists to more precisely chart the habitable zones of their stars. Another improvement was better handling of the statistics, although, as Natalie Batalha noted, surveys are inherently incomplete. You can't call up every citizen. You can't observe every star. In the case of Kepler, the limitation was serious. The spacecraft's orientation system failed before Kepler could complete the primary survey, which limited it to detecting planets that had orbital periods of less than about 700 days, about twice the duration of an Earth year. In an email, David Charbonneau, the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics, said he was slightly skeptical of the result. "The Kepler mission didn't detect many, arguably any, true Earth analogs, that is, planets with the same radius as Earth and orbiting at the same period, and hence receiving the same amount of light, and orbiting sun-like stars." As Natalie Batalha said at the time, "We don't yet have any planet candidates that are exact analogs of the Earth in terms of size, orbit, and star type. We still don't." As a result, the astronomers had to extrapolate data from the planets that they did see. Although these Kepler planets are Earth size, 1.5 the radius of Earth, they are presumably rocky. Nobody knows what they are like in any detail, nor whether anything does or could live on them. They are too far away for further study. So far, we know of only one planet, our own, that harbors life. But there are plenty of opportunities yet to find out. The Kepler measurement of Eta Earth only pertains to stars like the Sun, but in the galaxy those stars are vastly outnumbered by smaller, dimmer stars known as red dwarfs. 1/4 to 1/2 of red dwarfs also harbor habitable zone planets, according to work by Courtney Dressing, now at the University of California at Berkeley, although some astronomers worry that radiation flares from such stars would doom any life trying to get started there. Red dwarf planets were not included in the new analysis of Eta Earth. The red dwarf planets are relevant to the search for life because Kepler has passed the torch to a spacecraft called the Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite, or TESS, which was launched in 2018 to scour the entire sky for exoplanets within a few hundred light years of Earth, the local neighborhood. so far, TESS, or the Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite, has discovered 66 new exoplanets and has catalogued more than 2,000 candidates. George Ricker, an astrophysicist at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, and principal investigator for the mission, in an email said, "Most of those planets were expected to be found circling red dwarfs." He added, "Since about three-fourths of the stars in the solar neighborhood are M-dwarfs, that leaves open a very large discovery space for TESS in the decade ahead." Natalie Batalha said that young scientists in the future might yet find a way to improve the value of ITER Earth. Until then, this will be the de facto standard. "The value of ITER Earth is an important and hitherto unknown factor in a mathematical expression known as the Drake equation. It is used by astronomers to estimate how many technological civilizations might exist in the galaxy, and that we might be able to contact by radio or other means some cosmic day. It's time to move on to the next factor in the Drake equation for extraterrestrial civilizations, the fraction of these worlds on which life emerges. The search for even a single slime mold on some alien rock would revolutionize biology, and it is a worthy agenda for the next half century as humans continue to climb out of ourselves and into the universe in the endless quest to end our cosmic loneliness."
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, and how about listening to a thought-provoking saying from Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him, the vicegerent of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. "Do not make a sinner despair. Many of the sinful enjoy a happy end on repentance, whilst many of the seemingly devout rupture their deeds and deserve hell. Allah may protect us from hell."
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, in the name of God, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. And in this program, we are going to look at some principles of upbringing children so that the audience gets a detailed description of the matter concerning how to raise their children Islamically. The main source is the book Children in the Quran and Sunnah, compiled by Ayatollah Ray Shahri. And today we have in our studio guest speaker Sister Salma Khalfan. She is an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Ilmiya of Qum. Assalamu alaikum and welcome to the program.
Alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you so much for having me over.
We are very happy to have you. As I mentioned, today we are going to look at some of the principles. And one of the principles that I'm going to mention, inshallah, you're going to shed some more light on it. How important is dealing with justice towards children, either between the parent and child or between the children, like the siblings?
Good question it is. And it's of too much importance, I think, raising children by administering justice from the parents and, directly to the child or between the siblings, the children. And this can be done firstly by, of course, this is paramount, being affectionate to them and giving them the material resources. That means accomplishing their needs, the children's needs. And this matter of justice, we can look at it from two viewpoints. Okay. One is jurisprudential, the fiqhi one, and one is just from an upbringing perspective itself, psychologically based or, the reason behind it and everything. And here, in this program, of course, we are not talking about the fiqhi issues.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we will discuss the perspective of upbringing in itself, that how do we administer justice.
Okay, perfect.
So administering justice among children, when we see is giving them their allocated rights. This is one of the right. And when you're administering justice, you're actually teaching justice to the children. This is very important.
And how will we know their rights?
Of course, we should know their rights. Basic needs, of a child is love, apart from, of course, the basic material needs like food and shelter and clothing, and then the need to provide love and security,
yeah,
and, affection and all these things. So that's why I said giving them the affection and providing them the material resources, mm-hmm, it can help to give them this justice.
Okay.
You see? Mm. So that's the basic point here. And here we get this this information in this book, Children in the Quran and the Sunnah by Ayatollah Ray Shahri.
Yeah.
It's a very good book. Anyway, so the effects are such that the children themselves tend to observe the rights of the parents. And we are training these children to now respect their parents when justice is done. Justice itself, if you go and see what is the meaning of justice, keeping everything in its order, in its place, giving everything, allocating everything in its right place.
Very
so
true.
You see, like if a parent has a child, they're giving that justice through what the needs being granted to them in the favorable atmosphere, in a favorable place, in a favorable quantity, by a favorable quality.
Yeah.
Everything is favorable. So, put in the right place.
So basically, you're also trying to say that if a parent wants to be respected and given their rights, then they should make sure to give the rights to their children. Otherwise, yes, it's not going to happen.
Yes, it starts like that. It starts that when you make a child, because a child doesn't know the concept of, how this comes about, the justice and the respect.
Very true.
They have to be won over through this love. And the justice, when it's spread, that's how love comes about, right?
Yeah, very true. SubhanAllah, inshallah. So we're going to discuss more about this after the short break. Thank you very much.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Okay, so you're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran, and this is Islamic Upbringing. So we were just speaking about one of the important principles about justice with the children, and you mentioned some very important points. And you first of all told us that how we're able to administer justice is by giving and allocating the children's needs. And that the effects that come about is that after giving the children their rights and needs, then the children will give the parents their rights and needs as well. Like, they will also tend to respect them as well. And you also mentioned that justice in reality means allocating everything in its right place. And you were going to continue from there.
So I said that bit and I got over with that. And now I'm going to mention another effect of what are the effects of this justice that is administered to the children. Parent to child, and then it seeps to the child, and the child now will not be unjust to himself, and then his people surrounding him, his schoolmates, classmates, his friends, his relatives, his cousins, he will learn that, you know, that being kind is when you can practice this justice. You know, giving everybody the rightful place is administering justice. You know, inadvertently this child will learn what is justice. If you go and see very small children, when the parent is good to them and gives them their needs, then, you know, when there's a sibling around, you know, they'll share it out. They'll say that, no, our mother distributes this evenly, for example. They need to be taught only once or twice. Then they know when a certain thing comes, like a sweet or something, they need to share it.
So if we want it to come naturally for them, basically you're just saying that the parents should just try their best to do, like, to give the child their needs and rights.
And be just towards
and
them as
be
well.
Be just, So they have to put some extra effort.
That's right. And that's when they get prepared for the just government. You know, many people out there, unfortunately, they say, okay, now Imam Zamana will come, so what about me? I'm good in my place. They don't have this feeling of how justice is important in a worldwide, you know, level. How important it is. But when we lay so much stress about justice, and inshallah, we'll, in our other principles also, we'll talk a lot about how to affect this kind of nurture the child to have this social sense of justice prevailing in the, around the whole world. It's very interesting, you know, when you come to know about it, you feel, yeah, we can train our kids like that also. But it begins at home.
Yeah,
the foundation is laid at home.
So sometimes we don't realize that it seems small, but it makes a whole lot of difference and it impacts almost the whole world.
Like, yes, it does. And that's how we get our leaders in future, you know, in that dua that we read. And it's very preferable, I advise to the parents out there, to read this dua, Rabbana hablana min azwajina wa dhurriyatina qurrata a'yuni waj'alna lil muttaqina imama. That means, let my children be the, my dhurriya. Not only my children, their children. Even if you have no children, you can read the dua. Even if you're a spinster, you can read the dua. Yeah. So, waj'alna lil muttaqina imama. And let them be for the muttaqin, the pious people, a leader.
Yeah,
so, you see, like, pious people are so great, right? But a leader for them too. So we are preparing leaders, then they have to have this inculcation of justice in them, right?
Yeah.
And it begins right at home.
So I think this foresight needs to be instilled into the parents, inshallah.
Yes, yes, justice. And you know, it comes naturally, but sometimes they go wayward here and there.
Mm-hmm.
So every time, if it's like steadfast in them, they should consider especially treating the siblings, how you treat the child. If you made a promise that we are going to, inshallah, talk about in our next principle, that if you made a promise, like, you know, not to break the promise and things like that. So that's very important for justice.
Okay, inshallah. That sounds very good. So we're going to take another short break and we're going to continue in this very interesting discussion soon, inshallah.
Ya Muqri al-Khayrat, Ya Muqri al-Khayrat.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam said, "Be just between your children when granting things to them, in the same manner that you would like them to be just with you, in obedience and kindness."
Ya Muqri al-Khayrat, Ya Muqri al-Khayrat.
You're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. The show is Islamic Upbringing with our dear sister Salma Khalfan. So we talked about justice with our children, and you are talking about some of the effects that come about when administering justice. So what you said was that if you are just to the child, then the child will not only try not to be unjust with himself, but also with the people that surround him. And slowly, slowly, by being just to the child and by giving him his needs and everything, slowly, slowly you're making him grow up with such a strong and so steadfast that it's going to prepare him for the just government that's going to come, inshallah, with Imam Zamana. And slowly, slowly, if all the parents try and give the children their needs, then soon we will be having soldiers for our Imam, inshallah.
Yeah. And we should not forget that these needs are not only the elementary physical needs.
Yes, definitely. They're
those emotional needs, like, for example, keeping your promises, acting affectionate with each and every one of the child around you.
Definitely.
Not ignoring one child or buying many things for the one child and leaving the other. For example, you know, like we sometimes lay stress on one child because he or she makes us happy or things like that. No, the parent has to be very astute in this matter.
Definitely.
Another effect that comes about is that, and this is very interesting, is that it prevents a child from being envious and having this, you know, attitude of seeking vengeance, you know, like quarrelsome attitude.
Yeah.
So it's very important that the child doesn't have envy in his heart. Jealousy and envy come about when you see unfair distribution happening. Yeah. But when justice is done, the child will feel, I'm getting everything. And I'm enjoying it also. And I'm getting my new. And I'm happy. So you see, the parent, when they are being affectionate to one and not affectionate to the other, we see in riwayat, many riwayats stating that Imam used to pay attention more to one child who was stubborn and everything rather than to the other child, because he knew that child would feel jealous for the other child eventually.
Definitely.
So it's very important to not raise this envy in a child, jealousy here we were talking about, because envy, in, you know, it can be divided into the jealousy and the envious nature, as in ghibta, it's called, you know, like zealousy, as in zealousy is when you're happy that the other you have, I mean, you're happy that the other has. You don't want anything to, you know, the ni'mat to be gone from him, but yet you wish you had it.
Yeah.
So we are not talking about that envy. We are talking about that envy that you
wish
that
person didn't have it.
That person did not have it. So this envy doesn't come about when justice is being done. This vengeance doesn't come about when justice is being done. You see? We see it happening at large also, yeah? That vengeance and everything, because things were not maybe allocated to him at the right place.
Yeah.
This envious nature. So it, all the root is in justice.
Yeah. So that was a very interesting discussion, and inshallah we're going to continue this same discussion. Dear audience, thank you for joining us on the program. If you have any questions, comments or suggestions, please contact us at our email englishradio@irib.ir and visit us at our website parstoday.com. Inshallah, until the next program, fi amanillah and assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Inshallah.
Muhammad bin Salman. His name is now more conspicuously tied to the slaying of Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi and spearheading the bloody war in Yemen. But that's not what he wanted to be known for in the first place. A few years before he came to power as the Saudi crown prince and the de facto leader of the kingdom in 2017, he established a charity by the name of MISC, or Prince Mohammed bin Salman bin Abdulaziz Foundation, a non-profit foundation with the stated goal of cultivating and encouraging learning and leadership in youth for a better future in Saudi Arabia. MISC was in fact central to the so-called MBS project, aimed at promoting bin Salman as a compassionate leader who cares for the well-being of others. Much to the dismay of the young crown prince, MISC is now engulfed in a spate of scandals, including the Khashoggi hit. The foundation came under suspicion following a lawsuit filed in the U.S. last November, according to which MISC's former Secretary General, Badr al-Assakr, had interactions with two former Twitter employees, namely Ali al-Zabara and Ahmed Abu Amr, both accused of spying on private user data of some Saudi dissidents and passing it to Riyadh. The suit asserted that Assakr had provided gifts, cash payments, and promises of future employment in exchange for non-public information about Twitter users. The two employees, along with Ahmed al-Mutairi, who then worked for the Saudi royal family, tapped data from 6,000 Twitter accounts in the years 2014 and 2015. The aim was to identify, and needless to say, to punish some of the Saudi dissidents who would criticize the kingdom's ruling family on the social media platform. The three men all worked for Assakr, who was back then in charge of bin Salman's charity foundations, with a small fortune in his pocket. But that was not the first and last time Assakr, who still continues to have a senior role at MISC, hit the headlines for his non-philanthropic work. Just a few weeks after the killing of Jamal Khashoggi, the Turkish newspaper Yeni Safak ran the story that the Saudi intelligence officer at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul called Assakr four times the day Khashoggi was killed.
Mohammed bin Salman is not only the absolute ruler of Saudi Arabia, meaning that he controls everything from the functions of the state to murders that are carried out, assassinations that are carried out, to the charitable trust. And we shouldn't be surprised at all that he is still busy trying to brutally murder people. Mohammed bin Salman has not been held accountable in any way for the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, and we're right now at the anniversary of that.
critics say, beneath the surface of misc and gentle appearance of its former Secretary General, who happens to head bin Salman's private office, lie dark secrets that dovetail with the Saudi Crown Prince's real image, not the one burnished by his spin doctors. In the words of director of Freedom Forward, Sanjeev Berry, the Crown Prince and his henchmen keep trying to present themselves in a positive light. Yet behind the scenes, they spy on dissidents' Twitter accounts and are willing to take a bone saw to anyone who disagrees with them. Initially, a number of big names like the United Nations, the Gates Foundation, Bloomberg, Harvard University, and General Electric sealed partnerships with Minsk. But in the wake of the Khashoggi killing, more of them, like the Gates Foundation and Harvard University, cut ties with it.
Mohammed bin Salman, since he came into power, has been trying to sell us an image of himself, like a Disney World version of a Saudi crown prince, one who is a reformer, one who is bringing his country into modern era, but in reality he is a brutal dictator who has created the worst humanitarian crisis on the planet in Yemen, who chops off the bodies of journalists, who imprisons women for speaking out against him or for speaking out calling for their rights. And so, you know, he's trying to present this Disneyland image. But especially after Khashoggi's murder and looking at heroes like Lujain al-Hakloul, who remains imprisoned in Saudi Arabia, we easily see through this image and see him for the brutal, bone-saw, misogynist dictator that he is.
The scandalous story of Misk reached its crescendo in August this year, when former Saudi intelligence officer Saad al-Jabri filed a lawsuit in the U.S., alleging that the Saudi crown prince plotted to assassinate him by sending a 50-person kill team, dubbed the Tiger Squad, a few weeks after the killing of Khashoggi. According to al-Jabri, Misk conspired with al-Sakr and bin Salman to covertly recruit individuals to serve as agents and who participated in the hunt for him on U.S. and Canadian soil. The hitmen were offered employment at Minsk as a reward for aiding the Crown Prince and Mr. al-Sakr. Concerns about the so-called charitable foundation intensified in September 2017, when people from Minsk repeatedly asked one of Jabri's sons for contact details of Jabri himself and his wife, as well as about their residency status in the United States.
Salman is trying to paint himself as this modernizer, as this reformer. We are continuing to expose the Saudi regime for the brutal dictatorship that it is, for the war crimes that it commits. Saudi Arabia this year is hosting the G20 forum, but across the board, mayors of cities across America and across the world who have been invited are canceling. And they are canceling because of the imprisoned women, because of the brutal crackdowns on journalists, on dissidents, because of the brutal war in Yemen.
The Misk case begs this question. If Saudi officials can run spy rings, dismember a journalist, and dispatch a kill team all under the guise of a charity, what can they not do in an all-out military conflict like the Yemen war? Whether these are just the tip of the iceberg or not, Misk Foundation, first and foremost, embodies the Saudi duplicity entrenched in the kingdom's ruling family, where things are not really what they seem.